Welcome to End of Life University Podcast, where we share real talk about life and death. I'm your host, Dr. Karen Wyatt, retired hospice physician, and I just want to thank you for joining me here for episode number 384. This is the first episode of 2023, and I'm excited to be here for another year presenting you with interviews I conduct with people from all over the world, really, about end-of-life issues. I love doing this, and I'm so happy that I'm still here, able to create this content for you to enjoy. I want to start off by thanking all of you who've been supporting this podcast through my page on Patreon or by making donations through PayPal or Buy Me a Coffee. I appreciate you so much. I have one new supporter this week to thank, Sharon Patterson, who joined my Patreon page. And I'm really grateful to all of you who have helped me keep this show going for such a long time. And we're on track now to hit 400 episodes this year. And I'm really looking forward to that milestone. In a few moments, I'll be sharing with you a conversation I had with my recurring guest, Barbara Carnes. And today we're talking about the fact that people don't die like they do in the movies. And I think you'll enjoy this fun conversation that we had. But before I get there, I want to let you know about an upcoming online event with William Peters. William was my guest on the podcast back in episode number 329. He is the founder of the Shared Crossing Project and the author of the book At Heaven's Door. And he writes and speaks and does research on shared death experiences. My conversation with him was fascinating. I chose his book to be on the book list for A Year of Reading Dangerously last year, and we did a Q&A session together that was really well attended. And so I wanted to let you know about this event. It's free online, sponsored by the Shift Network, and it will take place Tuesday, January 17th. At 5:30 p.m. Pacific, 8:30 p.m. Eastern. I will leave a link to it in the show notes for this episode. It's free to register, and you can learn more about William Peters and his work and how he is working with the Shift Network to create more content. So I hope you'll take a look at that. Go to that link, sign up, and you can receive a replay of this event if you can't attend live. And that's coming up in just a couple of weeks, so I want to make sure you don't miss it. I'll also send out a separate email about it, but I thought I'd mention it today on the podcast. So now we will move ahead with my conversation with Barbara Carnes. I think you'll enjoy this one. Stay tuned afterward for a few takeaways and to say goodbye. So here we go. Today, I'm so happy to welcome back once again my friend and recurring guest, Barbara Carnes. And by now, Barbara shouldn't need any introduction if you're a regular listener to this podcast, because she's been joining me every other month. But if you're brand new to the podcast and even to the end of life world, maybe you don't know about Barbara Carnes and her amazing work. She is a hospice nurse, one of the pioneers really in the hospice movement. She's a speaker and author. And she's written the book, Gone From My Sight, The Dying Experience, which now most hospices that I'm aware of carry and give to families and patients. It's called The Little Blue Book. And if you work in a hospice, I'm sure you've seen it. And her newest book is By Your Side, A Guide for Caring for the Dying at Home, which is a fantastic bedside book that I highly recommend. It would be a great gift to give for someone who's caring for a loved one. And so you should check that out. And you can go to her website, bkbooks.com, and learn all about Barbara's wonderful work, see her videos that she's recorded there. But anyway, Barbara, welcome back. And it's so nice to have you here today.
Well, I always love coming talking to you. I mean, we just get some good stuff rolling.
So. We do. We have so much fun. And I wanted to let everyone know today we are talking about, and I'll lower my computer, people don't die like they do in the movies. And we're both wearing t-shirts that are also available at bkbooks.com. You can buy your t-shirt And it's a really great reminder. And I actually think, I don't know if you've heard from people who've been wearing the t-shirt and have had someone respond to them or ask about it, but it is a kind of a great conversation starter if you're wearing this t-shirt out in public and around family and friends. They might want to know what it means. I don't know if you have you had any remarks about that?
We were at a conference in California, and we being my two daughters and I, were doing this hospice conference, and we went to a Starbucks, and we had all three of us had our t-shirts on. We literally had everyone in line in the Starbucks talking about end of life as a result of the woman behind me saying, "What does that say?" And then the next guy and poor Starbucks girl was standing there wanting to take orders. And this whole line is having a discussion on end of life. And literally almost any time we wear them out in public, someone will go, "What does that mean? What is that?" So a great conversation starter.
It really is. And just think of the power of that, because you're putting a message out there wherever you go, and you never know when someone who reads that needs to hear about it, and they will approach you. They'll come up and ask you about it because it's something they're either wondering about or something personal for them that they'd like to know more about. And it's a great opportunity to just teach people and tell people some things. And not only that, but it's so very true that people don't die like they do in the movies. And you and I have talked before, Barbara, about, unfortunately, most people in our country, if they know anything about death and dying, it's because of something they saw on television or a movie, and it most likely was not factual.
Well, and then what happens is, because television and the movies have become our role model, then when people are at the bedside and they're watching mom dying and she's not doing, you know, saying something profound and then, you know, dead, that's not, when she's not doing that, when she's breathing like a little fish breathes, or she's frowning and grimacing, we, the watchers, think something's pathological is happening. Because mom's not doing like I think she's supposed to from what I see on television. And the thing is, people just don't die like that.
Yeah, and I can just think of countless movies when I've seen exactly what you described. Someone one moment is awake and talking, and as you said, saying profound things. Even I thought my mom might say something really profound right before she died. I was waiting for it, ready to write it down so I didn't miss a word, you know, because we really long for that to happen. And we've probably seen it happen enough times in movies and have really been touched by that. And we wish that would be the case. You know, as you said, the person is shown speaking coherently to everyone and it makes sense and it's a final message. And then they close their eyes and they're gone. And just like that, it's that easy and that simple. But so much happens during the dying process. We've talked about it before, but it's probably good for you to review that with us. What death really looks like when we're sitting at the bedside with a loved one.
Well, and as you were talking, I was thinking, I equate the hours and sometimes even days before death to labor. And just like we go through labor to get into this world, we go through labor to leave it. And think of a woman in labor trying to push that little puppy out. She's not aware of what's going on around and about her. She's not carrying on some nice conversation. She's concentrating on pushing and the hurt and getting that little puppy out. Well, it's just like that when we're dying. We're in labor and we're not aware of what's going on around and about us. We're doing our work, and our work is to get out of our body. And yet we, the watchers, have no idea that labor is going on or what it's going to look like. So our job is to educate we who work in the end of life to help people see what is normal and natural in death. And it's not always a pretty sight. And then what is pathological?
And I recently heard from someone who mentioned that when his mother died, he interpreted that she had terrible fear and anger on her face as she was dying. And that occurs to me. I've heard some people say that. Some people say, oh, their loved one looked so peaceful and beautiful. Others talk about grimacing and wondering, is my loved one suffering? Are they in pain or what's happening? And I'm sure you've seen had many different experiences like that with dying patients.
I have. And what is probably the most disconcerting and yet is so natural and happens so often is the silent scream. You know, the face all crunches up and it looks like they're actually going to scream. And that's just part of the energy and working to get out. But think of how scary that is for us, the watchers, when we don't understand that this is how people die. And yes, I have been with people who just are peaceful and they don't have any facial expressions. Their eyes are partially open. Our eyes aren't closed. They're generally partially open. And then they stop breathing. But that's the rare one. Most of the time you've got people agitated, moving around, picking at the air, at their clothes. That is part of the normal way that we die. But unless we, who are the educators, tell the family, then they think something's wrong.
And also, and some people do speak or say things at the very end of life. Others say nothing. But it, in my experience, much of the time, it isn't something that necessarily that's the family can easily interpret, though it will have symbolism if they actually sit down and think about it. They might be able to make some sense of it. But so I think for people who are hoping and waiting for this final, I love you, you know, I'll miss you, for, you know, from their loved one who's dying, that just may not happen.
No, and I think actually when the special things are said is often in the months before death, and even in the weeks, even though they're oftentimes confused and agitated, it seems in the weeks before death, sometimes it's like that curtain is raised and they'll look and they'll say something really important or nice and I love you and things that make sense to us, the watchers. But that's generally in the weeks, you know, and then that curtain goes back down. In the days to hours, you're just generally not going to get anything that you can hold on to.
Yeah. And I think I may have told you this before in one of our other conversations, but when my mom, a few hours before my mom died, she started to speak. And so of course I was right there. I'm going to write down every word she says. And what she said to me, or she wasn't even talking to me. She was just saying it, just words that were coming from her. She said, I want onion rings. And I was so disappointed. Like, what, why would she be talking about onion rings? Like trying to make sense of it. But later I remembered that when my mom was a teenager, she worked as a car hop at a drive-in and she always got to have one like meal at the end of her shift. And she loved onion rings. And she told me she would eat onion rings every single shift. And then I realized, oh my gosh, when I finally remembered that, I realized maybe she's doing like a life review. She's just thinking back of things in her life that were important to her. She wasn't thinking about what do I need to hear or no. She was reviewing things that were kind of helping her tie up loose ends or finish up her business. And I just happened to hear those words, but they weren't, she wasn't trying to give me a secret message or something.
Well, and in the months before death, the person that's dying is looking at their life. They're saying, what have I done? Who have I touched? And as they're withdrawing more within, they bring those thoughts within. And I think right up till the time that they're free of their physical body, that they're processing. They're saying, what have I done? They're reminiscing. They're looking back on their life. They're doing work, but that work can only be done by one.
And I believe it truly is work to separate consciousness from the physical body. And if you sit with someone in those last few days, that becomes apparent. They're working hard, and you see them, you know, moving and thrashing and sometimes breaking out in a sweat. You know, I mean, you can see that work is happening, and it's, as far as we know, it can be hard and challenging work. So our job, as you've said, is to just support them and be there for them, keep them as comfortable as possible, but not have expectations for ourselves that they should do or say something to help us.
Right. Well, and you know, that's why I call it labor, because they're working. And just like when we're coming into this world, mom's doing the work. She's not concentrating on anything else. She's doing the work. And when we're leaving, we're doing the work on many levels, and they're inside of us. We kind of touched on this, and I want to go back, and that is talking to and about people in our life as we're dying. You know, we'll often talk to people that have already died. You know, mom, or one time I had a woman saying, oh, the baby keeps crying. And one of the daughters said, I had a sister that died who was just a little baby. Oh. You know, and it just, things come together. It's like pieces of a jigsaw puzzle. You know, a billion piece jigsaw puzzle is each one of our lives. And the person that's dying is putting those pieces together. And what we, the watchers here, don't know where that piece goes.
Exactly. In the puzzle. Yeah, we're getting just a little fragments here and there of what's actually happening for them. And you mentioned before the breathing, because I think that is something families find upsetting, is what happens with a person's breathing as they are dying. And so it's really good to prepare people for it so they know. And that's what your book does. And I know that you as a hospice nurse always prepared families for exactly what they would see so that they wouldn't feel shocked or upset. But we can review that again here too.
Well, and the breathing in the hours to minutes before death. Well, actually, I'm going to go back to 1 to 3 weeks before death, when labor begins. You'll walk into a room and this person's sleeping with their eyes partially open and they aren't breathing. And you think, oh my gosh, he's dead. And then he starts breathing again. I call it start and stop breathing. How simple is that? But that's part of the labor. And that breathing occurs one to three weeks before death, when actually the hours to minutes before death are there, a person's breathing changes again, and they start breathing like a little fish breathes. Just think of that fish that opens and closes its mouth very, very slowly. That's how a person will be breathing. And that breathing gets slower and slower until they're taking maybe just 2 or 3 or 4 breaths in a minute. And then you think they're gone. And then all of a sudden, they'll take that deep breath, and then we have to scrape everyone off the ceiling because we didn't expect it. But that's part of what dying does. And just think, this is the spirit, driver of the car, whatever you want to describe this vehicle. And really our body is just a vehicle we use to get around in on this planet. And there's a driver that operates that vehicle. And those last minutes to hours is watching the driver get out of the vehicle that has worn out, that needs to be let go of.
Mm-hmm. And so it definitely seems to me when families are prepared and they understand what they're going to see, so they're less afraid, they can be present in those moments and sit through it and not be traumatized by it, but actually come to see beauty in it. But I'm sure some people who just were not expecting that don't know how to handle it when these changes occur in the hours before death. And so all the more reason why we want to keep educating people and make sure people haven't been kind of led astray too much by what they've seen on television or the movies.
Well, and I think it's important for those, the watchers, to know that a person can hear you even in, and I believe even in the moments following death, because we don't know for sure when the driver leaves the area. And so that's our opportunity to talk to the person that's dying, to say, to use this sacred moment to say everything that we wanted to say and know that the person can hear you. They hear you as if from afar. You know, if you're in that kind of halfway sleep, dream state, well, that's how I think that they hear you. They can't respond, but that's a wonderful opportunity to do and say what we want to do and say before they're gone.
So, yeah, so very true. And so to be prepared and have the courage to stay at the bedside, because it is a really profound moment, regardless of whether your loved one makes a statement that you'll remember forever or not, just being there as life ebbs away, it's an indescribable experience, I think, in many ways, what it's like to witness that. But I think it's so powerful and important. And so I really want to encourage people when they can to be there at that last moment of life, not be afraid of what they may witness or what may happen.
You know, and this is purely Barbara, but I think there are two times that we're closest to God. And that's when we're born, when we leave home, and when we die, when we go home. And we who are there can touch into that incredible sacred moment if we can put our fear, and all of us are going to be afraid at some point and to some degree during this moment. But if we can put our fears aside and touch into this sacred moment and experience, it's a gift that we will carry with us forever. And that's why our job as professionals is to neutralize that fear so that the people there will have that sacred experience.
And I'll mention in our last previous conversation, we talked all about that, how to make that the moment of death just before and just after a sacred experience and create sacred space. And there's so many really good tips in that conversation. And so I will leave a link to that episode in the show notes so people can go back and refer to that, because that was a really wonderful conversation. But you're right, we keep talking about this because it's just so important and because we need to keep educating people. And, you know, I think of all the things we'd love to educate people around death and grief, I just think helping people be less afraid of death and the moment of death, that could change everything. If that's all we did, if all we could do was talk to people about the message on the shirts, people don't die like they do in the movies, but it's sacred and it's beautiful. And please don't be afraid to be there with someone you love when that time comes.
Oh, so important. I can't, you know, we carry with us so much fear in today's world. And we have been so removed from the actual dying experience. You know, it used to be grandma lived at home and in the upstairs bedroom, and we were there, and it was a normal part of life. And over the years, we've become so medicalized that we expect the medical community to fix it, to alleviate death. And so we have lost the naturalness of it. And hopefully we I see that the tide is turning, the circle is coming around, and that we are, as a society, are more open to understanding that death happens and to try and create that sacred space. I think we're more aware than we have been in many years.
I think so too. I can see it as well. The awareness is growing. And each of us who is already open and already informed, if we can each decide that we're willing to be teachers for other people, we could make a big difference if we just talk with our neighbors. A woman who used to work as a medical assistant with my husband, she just stopped by our house, and she's on the way home to help care for her mother as she's dying. And so we had a great conversation about that just in that moment by just opening up and asking people questions about what's happening in their lives. You'd be surprised how many people are actually going through these situations right now and could use some information or some support.
Absolutely. You know, it's how do we get this message out? You know, and you are doing it with your podcasts. Hospice is doing it. End of life doulas are doing it. And I think it's reaching everyday people, you know, not people that have someone who's dying. You know, if we know the information ahead of time, before we need it, we've already neutralized a lot of the fear that we'll bring.
That is so very true. And I was just thinking that very thing the other day, because I know someone who's dealing with a terminal condition who has never thought about death and dying before. But what I realize is when you're faced with a terminal diagnosis, to sit down and actually think through what would I like to have happen when I die is overwhelming. But if you can actually think about that and process it and learn a little when you're healthier, when you're not dealing with a terminal condition, you can prepare yourself in a way so that if you do reach that state and you're given a diagnosis, you've already thought about it. It's not new to you. It's not so intimidating or so frightening because you've already considered it and you've already had some ideas in your mind of what you might want or how you might want things to be.
That before we need it, that's absolutely the time to look at it. And yet we as a society have it in our head, if I talk about death and dying, then that means I'll die. And so we're such a death-denying society. It really takes an act of courage to have those advanced directives before you need them. Think of the help that gives your family, your loved ones, so that they will have the support to make the decisions that you want in your life, because they won't know if you don't have it written down ahead of time. And if you have really strong feelings, which a lot of people do, is, you know, when do you stop the medical intervention? And that's addressed in advanced directives. And I think that is so key, because a lot of family members are going to say, oh, do everything because I want mom. I want her, even if I just have to hold her hand, even if I have her an hour more, I want mom. So we need to have it in writing, and that's a gift to our family.
That is so true. And as we talk about advanced directives, that's another important myth that I wanted us to dispel today, because I see this come up a lot of times. I see people struggling like, well, of course I want them to do CPR, right? You know, because that's where they start your heart beating again. That's really important. I want them to do that. And there are so many misconceptions about CPR because of, I think, television shows, medical television shows like ER and Grey's Anatomy. And I read a little study where someone actually sat down and they watched like a year's worth of episodes of some of these medical TV shows. They found out that on television, 72% of the time CPR works. The person is resuscitated, they come back to perfect health, and they end up walking out of the hospital on their own power. Well, no wonder people think CPR might be a good idea. And they're afraid to check no CPR when they do their advanced directive, because they have this idea that it's so very helpful, but that is so far from the truth.
Oh, well, And you can describe this better than I can. The physical damage that is done during CPR, all the things that are broken, and I'll let you address that. But that people have no idea that generally people are in worse shape, even if they can get the heart started. Their physical being is in worse shape. And whatever they died from in the first place, whatever disease their body died from, is still there. And so they're going to just have to die again in a short time. And I don't know about you, but I'd be really unhappy with anyone that put me through it again.
Yes, exactly. And the actual statistics say 23% of people who are given CPR in the hospital, which means it was witnessed and observed right away, so they got to that person immediately to do CPR, 23% survive. But the majority of those people have complications because of CPR, like broken ribs. They can have a ruptured spleen or a punctured lung. And many of them have brain damage because of a lack of oxygen to the brain. And so even of the people who may, their heart may start again and they may start breathing, many of them do not walk out of the hospital. They may go on and die several days later after this procedure. And so CPR, we know it's good when someone has an arrhythmia and we have the defibrillators, you know, emergency defibrillators, and can defibrillate someone in the field and get their heart started again, back into normal rhythm. For younger people who maybe have drowning or electrocution, that's when CPR actually gets someone heart started, but they're younger, healthier people without underlying conditions. So everyone who's considering that question for their advanced directives, they just need to have a realistic idea of what CPR is about, so that they don't choose it. Because I've seen 90-year-olds in nursing homes for whom they call 911 and bring the paramedics in and do CPR and rush them off to the emergency room, when it was really just their time to die, and what they needed was someone to hold their hand and just be with them.
And if you don't have a DNR, do not resuscitate order, and there's other names now that they use for that. If you don't have one and you call 911, their job is to try and start your heart. And so you really need, as part of your advanced directive, to explain, if my body gets to a place where it can't be fixed, then I want the doctor to sign a DNR. I want to be a no code.
And you're right. Even their job is to attempt to restart the heart, even if they are certain it won't work, even if they feel like it doesn't seem right to do this to this older person, even if they know it may cause harm. It's their job. That is the standard of care, that the default care that we have chosen in our country. So that's what they have to do. That's part of their emergency response to do it. And it's only when we speak up for ourselves and make sure they know we don't want that. Don't offer me that care. And that it's so important.
And I think in doing an advanced directive, we also need to assign someone who understands us as a durable medical power of attorney, someone who will understand what I want, who will speak for me medically if I can't speak for myself, who has the knowledge of me to say, I want a DNR on here. Mom wants to be a no code. Because there are times when we can't speak for ourselves. And if we can't speak, then the medical establishment is going to do everything they can to keep us breathing. And notice I didn't say alive.
But yes,
breathing.
To keep There's us breathing. And keep the heart beating. Well, and as you said, for the watchers, for the loved ones who are with someone who's in this process of dying, it can feel confusing in the moment. And it can feel like, well, shouldn't we do something right now? Shouldn't somebody try to resuscitate mom? Shouldn't somebody do something? And it can feel confusing to just let go and let natural death happen. But that, I believe, is what we need to prepare ourselves for so that we can be a support person at that time.
Absolutely. You know, it all goes back to education. And if we can educate ourselves about end of life before we need it, it will really ease us into the experience. It's going to be a hard experience. It's a sad experience, but it won't be as frightening an experience if we have the knowledge. Knowledge reduces fear.
Yes, and I think if we can look at it that dying is a natural process. It's meant to happen for each one of us. And why would we want to interfere with a natural process that's happening on its own time when it's the right time for our person we love? Why would we want to interfere? Because we can only make it worse if we do interfere. We can only increase the suffering. We can only prolong whatever is happening, and we're stopping the natural process or trying to. And that doesn't make any sense if we think about it. But being there, witnessing it, supporting it, and being present is by far the best thing to do that could make the biggest difference for our loved one.
Yeah, it will. Having that moment of love where you're just there speaks more than any words. And I think people don't know what to do in the days to hours before death. And it isn't what you say, you know, it's being there and just loving and supporting the person. Hold their hand, crawl in bed with them if you want. Just be there. That's the healing that we can give people, is that love healing energy.
So true. And I think this is a good place to remind people that there are some people who die alone. And no matter how much effort family members have made to try to be there and be at the bedside, there are people who still, the moment they die happens to be when everyone stepped out in the hall for just a moment, or, you know, and so that occurs also. And sometimes that's the right thing for the dying person.
Well, we have limited control over the time that we die. Now, operative word there is limited, but we also die the way we've lived. I had an email just recently from a daughter whose father was dying. And she said he always took care of us. He was really our protectorate. And she said, my sister and I were with my mother and aunt. Dad's dying, but he didn't die and he didn't die. And the hospice nurse said, you know, what about if you two girls step out of the room? Let's see what happens. Bingo. He stopped breathing and he was gone. He was waiting for those girls to be out of the room so he could protect them from this experience. And so there's so many dynamics that go into dying. It doesn't just happen.
And I've heard family members feel so guilty that they weren't there or that they did step out of the room for some reason. And always it's, you know, it happens in its own time at the right time. And there, I can imagine for some people may feel so connected to their loved ones that it's hard for them to take that final breath and make that final separation. And being alone is when they're able to do it, when they're able to finally separate and leave the body.
Yeah, because we die the way we've lived. And so if we're a protective parent or whatever, just know if you're with someone when they die, you're with them because they want you there. And if you wanted to be there and you didn't, and you tried to get there, but you weren't, then take the gift of love and protection that that loved one gave you.
Exactly. Because I don't believe I've ever seen a case where I could sense that a loved one was angry about dying because someone wasn't there. I mean, that I could sense that happening. It seems like things unfold in their own perfect way. And if I could do anything, I would take away any guilt that any family members or loved ones feel for not being there at the very moment of death. Because as you have said, our loved ones are actually there doing inner work within. They are less concerned about who's there or who's with them. They're not really needing things from us in that moment. They are doing their own inner work and following that timeline for themselves.
Right. And only they can do that inner work. And all we can do is be there to just be there. Just be there. Hold their hand. Just say, I love you, Dad. I will often say to families, I encourage them to spend time alone in the hours before death and talk to the person that's dying. And one of the things is to say, Dad, I know that you have to go. And I understand. I don't say it's not okay, because it'll never be okay for my dad to die. But I can say, I understand. And oftentimes people will try and stay here for their loved ones. And so if each person can give the permission, mm-hmm. just, you know, I understand you have to go, and you go whenever you're ready.
I love that. I love that. Acknowledging that there is kind of a natural time, whatever it might be, and that you're willing to honor it and to allow that to just happen.
Well, and that takes a lot of pressure off the person that's dying. Because, and when I say pressure, I really mean energy, because thoughts are things. And so that's why we want to neutralize the fear, because it's energy. And we want it to be a positive, sacred energy. And so it's healing for us, the watchers. It's healing for the person that's dying.
Wow, that's so true and so beautiful. The way you talk about it, that, you know, we can be mutually healed just through those moments without saying anything, just experiencing it and just being there as a witness. Well, I think to sum this up, I was thinking for myself, when I watch movies now that show someone dying, I try to think through, like, what did they get wrong? What did they miss? Or what are they not showing? And I get it. They don't want to show the entire dying scene realistically in a movie. I understand that. Though sometimes I wish there could be disclaimers, you know, that would come up to say to people, if you want to know about real dying, you should actually read about it. Don't depend on this movie to teach you. But just for myself, I think through what isn't real about what they're depicting. And so that was part of our wanting to have this conversation, because we can give people tools when they see movies to remember, what are they showing here that's a myth and that isn't realistic?
Well, in watching the movies, as an end-of-life educator, when I see someone dying, I think the director, the actors, all of those producers, they've probably not been with someone who was dying, let alone because of the cause that this actor is dying from. I said earlier to you about the only movie that I've ever seen that really depicted death and dying was one of the Godfathers. Mm-hmm. And Eli Wallach was in a movie theater, and he's sitting up and he's breathing like a little fish breathes. And that's how people die. And what I thought was, Eli's been with someone when they died, and that's how he knew. I don't think most of the actors or directors have actually been involved in real life dying. So they don't know how to project it, how to act it.
It's so true, because most people in our society haven't seen it or witnessed it. So yeah, that's such a good point. So to remember, you know, they're telling a story, they're depicting something the way they think it happens, but it's not very accurate. And to not base our own decisions on what we see on television or in the movies, to try to get educated and to help educate others as well.
Yeah. It's really sad that we as a country are so limited in our end-of-life knowledge, because that limitation affects how we live our best life.
That is so true. So true. And sometimes when we see people and hear people complain that they aren't finding enough meaning in life, like life doesn't feel joyful to them, or they can't find a purpose in life or see a reason for it, sometimes I think it is because they haven't embraced the fact that they'll die someday. This life it's limited. It's short. Like, you have to make the most of every moment of it.
You know, when I go to sleep at night, before I go off to sleep, I say, what have I done today that I've traded a day of my life for? And what was good about today? Where was the joy in my life today? And we get so caught up on our gerbil wheel of daily activities that what's the old saying? You forget to smell the roses. And that's true. So I check every night to see that there's some beauty in my life. And it may just be watching the squirrels, but, you know, that puts me to sleep on a positive note, and it reminds me how precious life is and how short.
That's beautiful. And that even on the worst of days, when everything has gone wrong and, you know, life seems to be falling apart, still there's beauty all around us. There's love, there's joy to be found if you can look for it. You may not recognize it on your own. You have to do a practice like you're doing, where you ask yourself, like, what have I seen today? What has been beautiful today? What have I encountered today? And it just to remind yourself of this preciousness of life. Well, I encourage people listening to us to get this t-shirt, People Don't Die Like They Do in the Movies. Because as we were saying at the beginning, it is such a good conversation starter. And now that you've heard our conversation about it, you kind of know some of the points. If someone asked you, what does that mean? You could say that, you know, the movies kind of glamorize death and dying, and they gloss over some of the important things that actually do happen. And it's good for everyone to educate themselves and learn about it. Like by reading Barbara Karin's books, Gone From My Sight, tell people about that book, because that is a great short book that educates people about the dying process.
Well, I was a primary hospice nurse, and I was on call one night, and mom is in the bedroom. She was not actively dying, but the family was scared because they didn't know that what mom was doing was what she's supposed to be doing. And I had the family in the living room, and I'm explaining to them the normal dying process. And one of the daughters was taking notes. And I thought, oh dear, you know, can't have that. So that weekend, I sat down before computers, sat down with a yellow legal pad, and I wrote what I wanted families to know about the normal, natural way that people die. I made it short, because if you're dealing with someone who's dying, you don't have time to read a book. You've got time to read 13, 14 pages in large print, no medical terminology. And yet I made it gentle, because I know the emotions that go with reading about mom, and mom's going to be doing this. And so we're reading it with our heart also. So short, simple, and it took on a life of its own. It literally has, and I look back and I think the reason it took on a life of its own is because the need was so great to understand dying. So then I have a companion, and that's the 11th hour. And where Gone From My Sight says, here's what's happening. The 11th hour says, here's what you can do while it's happening.
Mm, that's perfect. A perfect combination in those two books. And I wanted, maybe I'm going out on a limb to say this, but it seems to me, if we're asking people to think about their advanced directives and complete that, we need to make sure they have accurate information about what dying really is. And being aware that most people are not well informed about the dying process, if they're informed at all, it's from television or movies, that really, maybe one of the first questions we should just ask people is, what do you know about death and dying? What do you understand about it? Have you had any experience with it?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you really, I think, hit the nail on the head in that before you can fill out good advanced directives, you've got to understand. And how do you do that? How do you, you know, yes, we can Google, but I think if you pursue the knowledge, there's all kinds of material that will give you information on how to make your advanced directive and make it meaningful to you.
Yeah, very true. So for death educators out there, I think it's a I think it would be a good idea if you were doing a class on advanced directives, just go around the room and ask everyone, what have you learned about death in your life so far? What do you know of it? What have you experienced? Just to get a feel for, do people have really accurate ideas about what happens when someone's dying, or are they completely misinformed? And maybe that's where you need to begin so that they can make informed decisions for their advanced directives.
I would like to see churches who have study groups and classes. That would just be a wonderful place to start educating about end of life, what you need to know, what's real, what's not real. That's a great opportunity for any church group out there.
I love that idea. Church groups, book clubs, groups of people that already meet and gather and who are already close, are part of a community. What a great place to have some death education happen.
Yeah.
And we should give credit to, there are movies out there, there are documentaries that talk about death and dying too, and that depict death and dying more accurately. And so show those movies as an antidote in a way to the box office movies or the Netflix series that people are watching on television.
Yeah, good idea. Really good.
But, I did want to give one shout out though, a positive shout out on the series. Now I can't remember what channel it's on. From Scratch. I don't know if you have seen that, but that series has one of the most accurate presentations I've ever seen of what it's like for a patient with cancer learning, or actually not learning, about palliative care from the doctor treating the patient and the things the family went through at the end of life. From Scratch, it's called. It's really a beautiful story, but they did a really good job of portraying, I don't believe it portrayed the moment of death, but portraying the process leading up to it, and particularly the medical system and how reluctant the medical system was to even talk about death and dying and to recommend palliative care or hospice.
Yeah, I have written that down because I have not seen it, and it's now on my list toward the top.
I was just going to say, I think we could seek out movies that are more accurate, and most of them are documentaries, I think, that will show us, and I'll try to leave a list of a few in the show notes for this episode. But so if we want to counteract the effects of the movies and television we watch with something that is accurate, then those might be things we could draw on if we're doing a class or a workshop or getting our community together to actually watch a movie that has a more accurate portrayal of dying.
Oh, that, I'd love it. Yes. Get it out there for us.
Yeah, definitely. I'll try to come up with a list like that. So, but meanwhile, again, don't forget the conversation starter, this t-shirt. People don't die like they do in the movies. I know you have a lot of different styles and sizes, so everybody can find whatever they're comfortable with. And they just order online, right? And it gets shipped to them.
Go to the website and we'll send it out. Yeah.
Yeah.
The pictures are there and sizes, the whole bit.
Yeah.
BKBooks.com.
BKBooks.com. Also get Gone From My Sight, By Your Side, and The 11th Hour. That's, I forgot about that one as the perfect companion book too. So, well, Barbara, thank you once again for joining me. I just love talking with you, and we always have the best conversations.
We do. I look forward to this. I think we're doing good work, and thank you so much for having me, for thinking about us to do this for the community. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you for the t-shirt and for everything that you've done and continue to do, Barbara. And she's my recurring guest. So we're going to, every other month, Barbara and I will do an episode together. And I don't think we'll ever run out of things to talk about. We always have lots to say. So thanks again, Barbara, and take care.
I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Barbara Carnes. As always, I love talking with Barbara. I really liked all of this conversation. There were so many really touching moments of our discussion. But one thing Barbara mentioned that gave me goosebumps when she was describing for a dying person, it's like a billion piece jigsaw puzzle all coming together to make sense of their lives as they're in the process of dying. And I just loved that depiction and the idea that so much is happening for the dying person during that process, and that we can't possibly understand everything that's going on for them. And we are part of the jigsaw puzzle, but not all of it by any means, or even the most important part of that jigsaw puzzle, which is why we may not hear our loved ones comfort us or say what we hope they would say to us or give us messages, because the puzzle they're putting back together again is vast as they review their lives. And I thought that was just a really lovely metaphor for this process of dying and going through life review. So I just wanted to mention that. And I do encourage you to go to bkbooks.com, check out Barbara's books and the t-shirts, also look at her videos there. She has so much to offer people. And yes, we will come together again in the month after next. So let's see, our next episode will air in March of 2023. But as always, we come up with a great topic to discuss together, so you can look forward to that. Meanwhile, I'll be back next week with another interview, and I'll be talking with Tracy Wheeler of Endwell. And Tracy and I actually talk quite a bit about the series From Scratch during our conversation, and I think you'll really enjoy that. So if you would like to help support this podcast, you can go to eoluniversity.com/support, and you'll find out three different ways that you can make a small financial contribution to help me keep the podcast and the YouTube channel on the air. I appreciate it too if you tell other people about the podcast who might benefit from listening. And be sure to subscribe and leave a rating and review for the podcast wherever you happen to listen. So until we're together the next time, remember that we're here for love. That is really, really the most important lesson that you could learn about life. Just learn about love. So face your fear, as Barbara was talking about. Be ready for whatever life might bring your way, and love each and every moment of your very precious life. Bye-bye.